talk one we're on, the man and God. And it's not a short talk, and it's not an easy talk. It's a concentrate, hard talk. And so that's all right. I'm going to treat you like men, not like babies. You've got to work this talk, and I'll try my hardest to work on it. I do have, as you can hear, a real voice problem. So I'll stick the anesthetic in now, and let's see if we can get through it. Halfway through the talk, I'll have a break and you'll have a break because we're going to sing halfway through. Well, it's not halfway. It's halfway through in time, but not in the outline. Point six is about halfway. So just get yourself adjusted to the idea, right? Lest you think, oh, well, we've done, you know, five out of the six, and then you discover the reality. The text of the whole talk is, be on your guard, stand firm in the faith, be men of courage, be strong. That's 1 Corinthians 16. Sam Rayburn served as a speaker of the United States House of Representatives longer than any other person. He died in 1961. He came from a poor Texan family. Back in 1900, aged 18, Sam asked his father for permission to go to college, and his father told him that he had no money to send him there. But Sam said, I don't want your money to go, but your permission. His father gave him permission. Sam tied up all his meagre possessions with string, for the world, the family couldn't afford a bag, and headed off into the world. As he stood on a remote train station, his father stood quietly beside him. Just as the train drew in, his father thrust a roll of notes into his hand. $25, virtually all the money he had. As his son climbed onto the train, his father gave him his one piece of advice, which became Sam Rayburn's motto for life. Sam, his father said, be a man. But in the 21st century, who would know what it means to be a man? Or as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 16, 13, be a man of courage. I thank you for the invitation to be here at the men's convention. Your organisers are right to call men together to look again at what we as men are doing and what we should be doing and how we are to be living under the lordship of the Jesus Christ. It's great that you've made the effort to make it tonight. I'm sure it will be benefit to you, but more even to your families and to your church, and I hope to this great nation. Make the effort tomorrow night. The talk is slightly easier, but no better for that. As we start this ministry to men, let me start with the general introduction of the two talks with a question, what is man? And as you saw earlier, so you now see, there are just so many images of manliness available to us. There's the bodybuilder that you can have. I like the third one in particular. Then there's the tattoo that shows your manliness. Or you can grow a beard. There's all kinds of beards and facial hair available to you today. Here's four, three, four, five options available for your checking out for sartorial elegance later. If you're not up to that, then you can be really manly by going the bald look these days. That is also available to you. Real men don't grow hair on top. And then, of course, the ultimate of manliness is the athlete. Although they're so poncy, those sprinters, aren't they? The real athlete is the footballer, isn't he? Which has that kind of manly look about them, don't they? And then there's, of course, the soldier. He's the manly man, isn't he? Or the president, the man of power and influence to rule the world, which really is not the president, but the man behind the president, the wealthy. He is the man who is the man or indeed the man is the leader. And you can go to leadership courses everywhere these days to tell you how to be a leader, which by definition is how to be a man, unless you're a woman. What we need to do is start with the Bible's view of man. Because at the very fundamental level, the world and the Bible are in opposition now today. And Christians get caught between the two. For we want to be of the world and yet we want to be of the Word of God. Look at the world's understanding. For the world starts its understanding by looking at man, not God. Indeed, the great Enlightenment poet Alexander Pope wrote, "Know then thyself, presume not God to scan, the proper study of mankind is man." That is the essence of the anti-Christian element of the Enlightenment in this subject. For the world tries to define and understand man by the study of man. It's called anthropology. There's lots of different ways, though, you can study man. There's the biological man, there's the economic man, there's the psychological man, the humanistic man, the existentialist man, the anthropological man. There's all kinds of different men that you can think of. The biological man is you are nothing but the structure of your atoms. The economic man is that all your decisions in life are actually about providing for your clothing, food and shelter. And if you've got those, providing for your sense of significance. And so what's the Bible's understanding of man? The Bible describes man in relational terms. The creature of the Creator, made in the image of God. Man and woman, husband and wife, brother, father, son, citizen, child. And it's important to explore prayerfully what it means to be a man in terms of the relationships we have. So let's then turn to the more specific introduction to tonight's talk, which is about contrasting relationships. See, relationships are often two-sided. There's comparison and contrast. We're like each other, which is why we can relate. We're unlike each other, which is how we relate. In the two talks I'm giving tonight and tomorrow, you'll see that I'm starting with contrasts tonight and then moving to comparisons tomorrow. Seems a little negative to start with contrasts, but from a definitional point of view, it clarifies the issues. We're not this, we're not that, we're not this, we're not that. Then we can concentrate on what we are like. So we'll clear the ground a little by looking at man contrasted with God, man contrasted with child, man contrasted with woman. You can see there the headings 3, 4, and 5 we're going through in a few moments' time. And then come to the main heading of the talk, the man of God, which comes after we've sung a song. And that's the goal to which the whole talk is heading, how to be the man of God. The fundamental relationship is with God. It's from this relationship that all other relationships make sense, that we learn what it is to be a man and how to be a man. It's from this relationship that all other relationships are derived. So let's start with man contrasted with God, which is why we read in just a few moments ago that wonderful passage in Genesis 1, 26 and 27, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the seas, the birds of the air and the livestock." So God created man in his own image, in the image of God. He created him, male and female, he created them. This passage lies behind the whole understanding of what we are and who we are. At first glance, we would think of this as a passage of comparison, not contrast. We are like God, made in our own image, one of the favourite phrases we have. But look a little bit more carefully at the passage, will you? From this passage first, you'll notice that we are talking here of man, the human. Let us make man, let them. So God created man, male and female, he created them. Man is created male and female, for the word man refers not just to masculinity, but to the whole of humanity. And in the Bible, as in life, we sometimes can't divorce man from humanity. And in our discussions of men and women, we must remember that women are as much man as man is man. See, when God gave Moses the commandments, he told us not to cover our neighbour's wife. He doesn't say don't covet your neighbour's husband. Much of the Bible is addressed to man, males, but doesn't mean that it excuses women from obeying the commandments. Let's look at this passage then in Genesis 1, 26 and 27. So the second observation I'd like to make from this passage is the great contrast that we are creature, not creator. Let us make. Are words we rush past too fast. We go to in our own image. That's the bit that we like to hear. You see, we don't make God. He makes us. We don't own God. He owns us. We don't determine what we will be like. He determines what we will be like. We don't make him for our purposes. He makes us for his purposes. The passage comes towards the end of a massive chapter on God sovereignly creating all things by his word. Creating out of nothing, making things that are not an extension of himself, but quite different to himself. And we are part of that creation. I know we're a special part, but we are part of that creation. We'll come to our specialness in a moment, but don't race to that before you come to understand we are part of the creation. We are like the animals in being creatures. We're not like God in being uncreated. So we don't determine what is man. We don't, like the world, study man to understand man. We listen to God to understand man. What God says about man, for God has his purposes in creating us, and he, not we, define who and what we are. One of feminism's great errors is in rejecting man's right to define what a woman is, asserting the woman's right to define what a woman is, and rejecting God's right to define what a woman is. Man should never have defined what a woman is. We should have left it to God in the first place. But the alternative to our definition is not the woman's definition, it's God's definition. This is only an expression of the common error of all individuals that we claim the right to define ourselves. I am the master of my own fate, the captain of my own soul. I did it my way. And so we reject the sovereign's right, the right of the creator to define us. This desire to define ourselves is what the Bible calls sin. And so the third observation about the contrast between God and man is that we are sinful. Come back to our passage in Genesis. God said, let us make man in our own image, in our own likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the rest. So God created man in his own image, in the image of God. That is, being a human means taking responsibility for the world, because we are called upon to rule over the world. And a ruler is one who takes responsibility. But we are to take responsibility like God, not in our own right, not our own way, but under his authority. We are to be made in his image in order to rule the world. And we are given responsibility to rule the world in his image. Here is introduced the great disaster that befalls us in chapter 3 of Genesis, when, listening to the voice of his wife instead of God, Adam obediently ate the fruit of disobedience. He ate in defiance of God's determination of how he was to till and keep the garden. He rebelled, And he took us, his children, his family, into his rebellion, so creating a huge and seemingly unbridgeable gulf between us and God. A gulf that God has bridged in the incarnation, but more importantly, in the sacrificial death of his Son, in the resurrected Lord Jesus Christ. That's why the proper study of man is Jesus, the man of God. But I get ahead of myself. At this stage, though, notice the contrast between God and man in our sinfulness. For now, we can't generalize from man as we see him to man as he should be, because we are sinful. We were created to be one thing, to live one way, even to be what we were, but all that is now taken away from us because of our sinfulness. So if you think the proper study of man is man, you will study sinful man and not understand true man. The contrast with God is, though, only one contrast. For in the Bible, we also see man contrasted with child. 1 Corinthians 13 says, "When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put childish ways behind me." That is, in being a man is to be mature. In chapter 14 he writes, "Brothers, stop thinking like children. In regard to evil, be infants, but in your thinking, be adults." See, I can't talk at a men's convention and give you a short, simple, easy chat, because that's not treating you as men. If you're going to be a man, don't be a child in your thinking. Get serious. Think like a man. Be adults. It's when you put away the foolishness bound up in the heart of a young man and take upon yourselves the responsibilities of life. Up until the age of 25, the male brain has not fully formed. The last part of the male brain to form is the part that recognises risk intuitively, which is why insurance policies for drivers under 25 have to be higher, and why we recruit men at the age of 18 to go into the trenches and think that they can jump out and run towards the machine guns without being killed. You see, it's got to do with, you don't think as an adult until you grow as an adult. Your brain actually is not fully developed till you're an adult. That's why young men get so drunk. But when you put away the foolishness of childhood, when you no longer live under the protection and provisions of your father's house, nor the rules and requirements of it either, when you enter into your independence as an adult member of the community, then you're a man. "Sam, be a man," Mr. Rayburn Sr. said as his son climbed onto the train. And Kipling finished his famous verse, his famous poem, "And which is more, you'll be a man, my son." But the Bible contrasts man not only with God, not only with children, but also with women. There's a clear distinction in the Bible between men and women. They are both human, therefore they're both man. But yet, male and female, inside humanity, they are created. So let's turn our focus away from man the human to man the masculine. I'll call him to the male. At first glance, there seems to be very few parts of the Bible specifically about men. They're hard to see because they're addressed to men frequently not as men, but in our relationships with others. You see, the whole Bible is addressed to men. But when you want to address men as opposed to women, well, then you're addressed as sons or as brothers or as husbands or as fathers. To study the role of women in the Bible requires looking up women in our concordance, though remembering that anything said to humanity as a whole refers to women as well as men. However, when it comes to study men in the Bible, you can't look up the concordance and look for men. It just is not there, or it's there everywhere. We have to look at words like husbands, fathers, sons. We have to look up men in their relationships. In contrast to women, we come to discover more about what it is to be a man, what manliness is, what masculinity is. And the two characteristics particularly to note are responsibility and courage. First man is to some degree, in contrast to women, to be responsible. That is being a man. More than being an adult in contrast to a child, more than being a responsible adult, it's to be a responsible male adult. And as such, it involves taking responsibility for more than yourself. It also involves taking responsibility for your household, providing for it, governing it, protecting it, directing it, teaching it. It's the old-fashioned meaning of the word husband. Husband is not male partner. When you ever use the word partner to refer to a domestic situation, go cut your tongue out, would you? Your wife is your wife, not your partner, unless you're in business with each other or playing tennis. She's your wife, not your partner. And you're not her partner, you're her husband. It's a very great difference. The concept of partnership that is being imposed upon us is the failure to understand the nature of humanity and the nature of family life. And so, what is a husband? Well, the old word meant a prudent and frugal manager. A prudent and frugal manager. Animal husbandry is looking after the animals, is caring for them, is providing for them, is to make... That's the word husbandry, you see. The word wife means woman. It's what is meant by being a father. Remember Joshua's declaration. As for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. His decision was not his alone. His decision was for his household. As for me and my household, he didn't go and have a little seminar with all the children and ask, now, would you like to serve the Lord or would you prefer to serve the Baals? Let's have a little vote on this subject. He was a man. It was his household. His household was going to serve the Lord, and he would make sure they did. His decision is not for him alone. It's for him and his household, just as Adam's decision was not for Adam alone. It was for him and all his household, which is all of us. Oh, that Joshua had been our forefather. Men have responsibility for their households. It's not called the sin of Eve, but the sin of Adam. And it's not said, as in Eve all died, but as in Adam all died. Who was the first sinner? Adam. Though Eve ate the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil before he did. But he was the sinner. Because, as God says in Genesis 3:17, you listened to your wife and ate from the tree. She was deceived. He did it knowingly and intentionally. Generally, we want to encourage men to better communication by listening to their wives. But Adam's listening was not a matter of better communication. It was a matter of submission. The Hebrew phrase to listen to the voice means to hearken to the voice, to submit to the voice, to obey the voice. That's what he did that was wrong. Instead of gently teaching and correcting or even rebuking his wife, instead of pleading to God for his wife's pardon and mercy, Adam accepted his wife's leadership. He hearkened to her. She was deceived, but he was disobedient, and he obeyed her rather than God. And so his household is the household of disobedience that we were born into. Because being a man involves this role of responsibility for the provision, for the protection of the household. A characteristic of manliness is this second thing, courage. or bravery. Not giving way to fear, but laying down our lives in the protective service of our household. And therefore it involves warfare and strength. When Paul wants to challenge the Christians in Corinth to stand firm in the faith, he writes, "Be on your guard, stand firm in the faith, be men of courage, be strong." Actually, the phrase "men of courage" is one word. It's actually "be men" or "be manly." The King James Version has "quit you like men." It's a lovely phrase, isn't it? The English Standard Version has "act like men." The NIV is right to pick up, you know, "be courageous like men," because that's what manliness is, courage as well as responsibility. Now, why does the word courage or bravery come to mean manly? Why is the word manly translated as bravery or courage? Because throughout the Bible, masculinity and manliness has to do with bravery and courage, with warfare and fighting. For example, when Israel took the ark into battle against the Philistines were initially afraid, but then the Philistines said to one another, "Be strong, Philistines, be men, or you will be subject to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight." When David is dying and passing on his kingdom to his son Solomon, he says, "I'm about to go the way of all the earth. So be strong. Show yourself a man." Manly is a strange word today. You don't hear it very often these days, do we? It's not the word we generally see as positive. The feminists have talked us out of it. It's no longer praiseworthy adjective to have masculine virtue. In Sydney, there's a very famous beach suburb. The first governor of our colony, Sir Arthur Phillip, yes, it was all convicts then, you're quite right, our first governor called it manly because he was so impressed by the noble and manly bearing of the indigenous peoples who were there. On a subsequent visit to one of Manly's indigenous men, a man by the name of Willaramming speared Governor Phillip, who survived the spearing but wouldn't punish the manly man because he was defending his people. Why then don't we like this Bible's teaching about manliness? Two reasons that come immediately to mind. Firstly, because quite rightly, we don't want to find masculinity in violence. We should, as Christian men, be anti-violence. For the man of God is not a man who likes violence. Those who enjoy violence itself, the violent man, is morally sick. Listen to the scriptures on this. Here's some quotes from Psalm 140. "Rescue me, O Lord, from evil men. Protect me from men of violence. Keep me, O Lord, from the hands of the wicked. Protect me from men of violence. Let slanderers not be established in the land. May disaster hunt down men of violence." Or you go across to the book of Proverbs, chapter 3, "Do not envy a violent man or choose any of his ways." Chapter 10, "The mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life, but violence overwhelms the mouth of the wicked." Or chapter 13, "From the fruit of his lips a man enjoys good things, but the unfaithful have a craving for violence." The man of violence is never the man of God. And yet manliness has to do with warfare and fighting. It's not like violence is quite different to being a pacifist. I used to be a pacifist in my youth, and I used to justify my pacifism from the Bible. And I was wrong. The Bible does not teach pacifism. In fact, the Bible keeps calling God the God of hosts, which is a lovely word because we don't know what it means. But check it out and you'll see that doesn't mean he entertains lots of dinner guests. In case you didn't know, as I didn't know as a young man, the word host means army. He's the God of armies. It's very hard to be a pacifist and worship the God of armies at the same time. I found it impossible. So I've got to hate violence, yes, but defending the right with justice, defending your family, your nation, your household, is not loving violence, it's being a man. The second reason we don't like the Bible's teaching is that it's so politically incorrect. Some of you know me as well, and I don't care about being politically incorrect, but I know that some feel nervous on anything that is going to be politically incorrect. And I want to say to you, tough. Within the Bible, it's not the role of women or children to rule the household or to defend the family or to be the warriors in battle. Listen how the Bible talks of women in warfare. In that day, the Egyptians will be like women. They'll shudder with fear at the uplifted hand that the Lord Almighty raises against them. That's Isaiah 9, or in Nahum 3. Look at your troops. They're all women. The gates of your land are wide open to your enemies. Fire has consumed the bars. Or in Jeremiah 50. A sword against Babylon's horses and chariots and all the foreigners in her ranks. They will become women. A sword against her treasures. They will be plundered. Or Jeremiah 51. Babylon's warriors have stopped fighting. They remain in their strongholds. Their strength is exhausted. They've become like women. Notice how being killed by a woman is such a disgrace. Hurriedly, in Judges 9, he called his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and kill me," so that they can't say, "A woman killed him." So his servant ran him through and he died. What a disgrace to think you were killed by a woman. And what about the great women leaders? I suspect you may ask. And that's the very point of the female leadership of women like Deborah. It's not a sign of normality that Deborah was a judge in Israel. It was a sign of the judgment of God on a sinful nation that it had to be led by a woman instead of by Barak, whom God called upon to lead, but who was too gutless to do it. Though he's a hero of faith in Hebrews 11, Barak is one of the great wimps of the Bible. He wouldn't fight unless Deborah came with him and held his hand. God had promised him the victory, but he was still too afraid to go and fight. So he came and asked Deborah to go with him. So instead of having the enemy Sisera delivered into his hands alive, Sisera was going to be killed by the woman Jael. You remember the account of the woman and the tent peg through the temple as he was asleep at night. Don't hang around with Kenites and have sleep in their temple. Their women are pretty violent. Tent pegs through the temple, I've always thought was a... Anyway, but listen to what Deborah says. "Very well," Deborah said, "I will go with you. But because of the way you are going about this, the honour will not be yours, for the Lord will hand Sisera over to a woman." Because of your cowardice, the victory will be given to a woman rather than to you. Now, we may not like this view of man as warriors, soldiers, protectors, but it's the true way of life and death. In the mid-1990s, we had a dreadful massacre at a place called Port Arthur in Tasmania, where a seriously deranged man killed 35 people in a shooting frenzy. I don't know if you remember it or not. Our papers recorded the deaths of the people. It was a huge spread saying who got killed, where and how and what was happening. Just listen to some of them, but the whole string of them was just like this. Jason Winter, 29, winemaker from New Zealand, working in Hobart, shot dead in cafe after throwing himself in front of his wife and son to shield them. Dennis Lever, 50s, jewellery store owner from Redcliffs on holidays with his wife who survived, shot in the cafe after pushing his wife under a table. Ron Jari, 71, retired, a fruit grower from Redcliffs on holiday with his wife, shot in the cafe while trying to push his wife to safety. Peter Nash, 32, painter and decorator from Laverton, Victoria, on holiday with his wife, shot dead as he shielded his wife in the cafe. Raymond Sharp, 67, from Kilmore in Victoria, on holiday with a member of golf club, shot in the cafe while trying to protect his wife. Man after man after man was manly at that moment of crisis. The only woman who was killed shielding was the woman without her husband shielding her three little children. In September the 11th, a man in particular showed this courage and leadership. His name was Todd Beamer, a fine Christian leader, who led the other passengers into battle with the hijackers and brought down a plane in a field, the plane that was supposed to land in the White House. In the Bible, children and women ruling over men is a sign of the total collapse of the created order, the conquest of sin, and the judgment of God. So, for example, Isaiah 3, infants are their oppressors and women rule over them. Oh, my people, your guides lead you astray. They turn you from the path. This understanding of men's ruling is reflected in 1 Corinthians 11, where we read in verse 3, "Now I want you to realise that the head of every man is Christ, the head of the woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God." And it's reflected in the pastoral responsibility of every husband towards his wife. For if in church the wives have a question, we're told in 1 Corinthians 14, they should ask their own husbands at home. Now, so far, we've been looking at what it means to be a man, to be manly, in contrast to God, in contrast to children, in contrast to women. All this has been kind of clearing the ground to look at what it means to be the man of God. But so that our brains can have a refresher and so that our bottoms can have one too, we're going to stand and sing. We're going to sing a great song whose name totally escapes me. A great God. Oh, great God, we're going to sing, which is a good thing to do. And then we'll come back at point six and do the second half of the talk.